Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the intensifying war in Syria, where the embattled Assad regime resorted to the use of fixed-wing aircraft today in what is seen as a serious escalation. Joshua Landis, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, who writes the daily newsletter on Syrian politics, Syria Comment, joins us to discuss the endgame in Syria and the possible use of WMDs. Then we'll speak with the executive director of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, David Clossy, about the sentencing today of the first high-level official in the Catholic Church to go to jail for covering up the abuse of children by Catholic priests. We'll discuss the long cover-up and the billions spent to hide what seems to be a systemic problem within the male-dominated Catholic clergy. Then finally, we'll look into the pain in Spain as speculators pile on, forcing up the borrowing costs of Spanish debt to unsustainable levels. Anthony Geist, professor of Spanish and comparative literature at the University of Washington, Seattle, joins us. He is just back from Spain, and we will discuss how the average Spaniard is coping with austerity and soaring unemployment that again exposes the weakness of the political leadership of the Eurozone that appears consistently unable to get on top of a growing economic crisis. Joining us now is Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And clearly the civil war, which the Red Cross have now designated, that there is a civil war going on in Syria, it's intensified today with the bombing of Aleppo by Syrian Air Force fighter planes. That's considered a significant escalation in the conflict. And then you also have the recent statements by a Syrian government official acknowledging the existence of weapons of mass destruction, saying they won't be used against the Syrian people, but they would be used against foreign invaders. This is starting to get ugly, surely.
It is getting ugly. And we've seen forays by the opposition into the heart of Damascus. They were pushed out, but leaving quite a bit of devastation behind. The regime has tried not to use airplanes, but we've seen them steadily ratchet up the amount of force that they're using. First going to tanks, then using heavy artillery in the cities, and now helicopters, and now air attack planes. So the situation is deteriorating badly for the government, and we've also seen over the last several weeks a series of high-level Sunni defections from the regime. So that the basic alliance undergirding the regime between Sunnis and Alawites has now in falling apart. It hasn't completely come apart, but it's falling apart quickly, and we've got new defections today of ambassador for Cyprus. But the explosion in downtown Damascus that killed a number of the very, top security people in the regime. So things are going very badly for the government, and it's unclear how this is going to play out because there are over 100 militias active in Syria as part of this Free Syrian Army.
Well, the Iranians, of course, have taken a role in this from the beginning. There are varying reports suggesting that in many ways, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps are micromanaging a lot of the response from the Free Syrian Army. The commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guards said that decisive blows would be struck against Syria's enemies, particularly the hated Arabs, if they intervene in this conflict. So you have Iran putting its red line down. You have Russia now apparently urging Assad to adhere to his international obligations regarding their chemical arsenal. I would assume that the United States has told the Assad regime if they use chemical weapons against their own people, that's the red line at which the U.S. and NATO would get involved. So walk us through these red lines as much as you understand them, Joshua Landis.
Well, both the Israelis and the U.S. have been talking about what to do about the chemical weapons. And Jihad Mekdis, he's the spokesperson for the Foreign Office in Syria, his statement yesterday coming out and saying we will not use them against, you know, in this internal struggle, but if anybody attacks us, we will, is, again, trying to make clear, I think, trying to push off any possible invasion or incursion from the U.S. and Israel to destroy the chemical weapons, but at the same time letting other neighbors like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, know that they shouldn't intervene more. And this is Iran's statement. It's the same thing. Iran, when they talk about the Arabs, mean the Gulf Arabs and Saudi Arabia, which is the major financial backer for the opposition and the rebels in Syria. So Iran is backing the Syrian regime with money and arms. Saudi Arabia is backing the rebels with money and arms. And, of course, the international community, United States and Europe, is backing the rebels with non-lethal aid. But presumably the Saudis and the Qataris and the Gulfies have got enough money. It's the intelligence that that America can play an important role with. And Russia, of course, Iran and China, too, are defending Syria, perhaps less with weapons today, although they have been the main suppliers of weapons, but in the UN, as we saw, by vetoing and giving moral support.
Well, I don't imagine, though, Joshua Landis, that Israel would ever intervene, would it, unless there was evidence that Assad was transporting the chemical arsenal to Hezbollah.
Right. You know, unless they feel that the chemical weapons are going to get out of government control and that the government will lose control and that they could go to al-Qaeda-type elements, any kind of a... The problem for Israel, of course, is that they don't want anybody to get those weapons because once they go to militias, they can be traded, they can be sold, they lose control. If the Syrian government has them, you can threaten the Syrian government, and it is accountable. It's got an address, but these militias don't necessarily have return address, and you don't know where they can go to. It could go to Hezbollah, could go to Hamas, could go to many different groups that would later become troublesome for Israel.
So, again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. We're talking about the deteriorating situation in Syria, where there's a likelihood of the use of chemical weapons. There's already been the employment of fixed-wing aircraft, which has been considered a red line that the Assad regime have crossed. And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that the rebels will eventually form safe havens inside Syria. Now, that could be interpreted as being pretty loaded, couldn't it, Joshua, that what the Secretary of State's saying is that if the Free Syrian Army creates safe havens, then that means that essentially those areas would be protected by outside forces? Is that...
You know, that is a line that I don't think the U.S. has really determined yet. Obviously...
Well, how would they be safe? I mean, who would guarantee their safety? That is
the big question. The United States has bent over backwards not to get involved militarily in this conflict, creating a no-fly zone over Syria, shooting down the Syrian Air Force, of course, puts the United States in deeply involved in this because they'll have to take out any anti-aircraft missiles before they go in and shoot down the airplanes. Now, I suppose they could do this in a number of different ways, but once you begin to do that, you increasingly take responsibility for the troubles in Syria, and you do it, knock out the planes, presumably to bring down the death rate. It would be for humanitarian reasons. And then when you destroy the regime, let's say you do, and the death rate goes up, should it go up if there were civil war, as it did in Iraq, then do you have to intervene in order to bring it down and become adjudicator in a civil war? That's what I think Hillary Clinton is trying not to do, and that's why they've said that they will not intervene in Syria before the elections, and that's why the NATO has said they will not intervene in Syria, saying that this is not Libya. So I think the West may not be saying that they're going to intervene militarily. They may be saying that the opposition is going to win one way or the other. And that already much of Syrian territory has fallen out of government control into opposition control. Now, the opposition can't guarantee that it can hold it forever, because especially as the government begins to use these fixed-wing airplanes, they're wreaking havoc. But as we're seeing, the opposition is moving into the two main cities. Both Aleppo and Damascus have seen opposition fighting, and that was the red line before for the regime. Had been able to keep the rebels out of downtown, the big cities, for fear of a Tahrir Square moment, that it would just be overwhelmed, and government offices would be overwhelmed if the people in the big cities came out. And that's what the Syrian opposition today is focused on, is getting into the downtown Damascus particularly, because once they do that, it becomes very difficult for the Syrian regime to take it back. And in taking it back, they have to destroy the downtown capital city, which turns everybody against them.
Well, I think probably it's fair to say, Joshua Landis, that the majority of the Syrian people are against this regime, and they probably have been for decades. They just haven't had the ability to do anything about it because of the pervasive repression of this regime that put on a very friendly outward face. But inside, there was a serious red line that, you know, as long as you maintain the fiction that we, the Assads, are destined to be your leaders and accept it, everything's fine. The minute you step out of line, you get crushed or tortured or disappeared. I mean, that's been the compact, and that's broken down. But it's the fear factor that's still there, because they seem to be prepared to destroy these cities rather than allow the people to coalesce in that Tahrir Square moment that you mentioned.
Well, that's becoming increasingly clear, and that's what they're doing. And I think many people thought that when it came to downtown Damascus, Assad would shrink from destroying downtown Damascus. But Homs, a city, the third largest city in Syria, has been destroyed. Hama, of course, was destroyed by his father, the fourth largest city. But Damascus, clearly, the regime resides in Damascus. All the government offices are in Damascus. When this regime loses Damascus, it will become essentially an Alawite militia on the ground, and it will no longer have any claims to being a Syrian army.
And do you think that that's inevitable? It seems.
I do think it's inevitable. I think that's where the opposition is headed. That most of the Western world and the Gulf are committed to that outcome, and they have said that they will. You know, Saudi Arabia and Qatar are reputedly have increased the inflow of arms tremendously in the last few weeks, and I think we'll continue to ratchet up that effort, because I think they see the regime hanging by a thread. They want to finish this and tip the balance in the favor of the opposition.
Again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. So this would probably end then without any intervention by Western powers. I know that the French and the Saudis at one point weighed in on the White House. Sarkozy wanted to use the aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle, along with the Saudi Defense Minister Salman, to use their air force and cross over Jordan in a coordinated French-Saudi attack on Mount Qasum, I think it's called, the palace.
Palace.
Just on the outskirts of Damascus. And that was vetoed by the White House, who were expected to provide electronic cover to jam the Russian anti-aircraft missile. So there are some people out there itching to pull the trigger.
Well, of course, Sarkozy is no longer.
And I think
France. So.
Yeah, exactly. I think Obama figured that the guy was trying to rescue his presidency.
I do, and I don't think that Obama wanted to get sucked in, because that's the way they, in a sense, they went into Libya, and it turned into a much longer battle. And I think everyone believes that Syria will be much more complicated, and the downside will be the potential for a civil war. And that's because the opposition is so fragmented in Syria. That, I think, is the real cautionary, you know, that's the real problem for this administration, is that they don't want to get into another nation-building project in a big Arab country. America's proven that they're not very good at that, and I think that's why Obama's got his heels dug in and is trying not to be sort of pushed into taking on Syria.
Well, we'll wait and see what happens in the next couple of days when his challenger Romney meets with his close friend, the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. I thank you for joining us, Joshua Landis.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the sentencing today of a Catholic Monsignor, the first ever to go to jail for covering up child abuse.
It's all about strikes now, so it would strike in me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Clossy, the Executive Director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, the largest and oldest self-help group for victims of clergy molestation in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Clossy.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And today is a landmark case in the sentencing of Monsignor William Lynn in Philadelphia. He was found guilty in June of child endangerment and has been sentenced for 3.5 to 7 years in prison. And this is the first time that U.S. prosecutors have charged church leaders for failing to stop the abuse of those in their care. How does it strike you as a member of an organization of victims of clergy abuse?
Well, no one, of course, takes any kind of glee or joy when an individual is sentenced to prison. But with that said, this is definitely progress. If we're going to protect kids in this society, we have to not only pursue those who commit child sex crimes, but also those who conceal child sex crimes. Because when you conceal child sex crimes, you essentially enable even more child sex crimes. And this is, as you pointed out, the very first time ever, despite the fact that 6,100 American priests are accused of molesting tens of thousands of kids, this is the first time that a complicit church supervisor has been criminally prosecuted for hiding those crimes. So it's definitely a significant development.
Well, the defense, of course, argued that the Monsignor William Lynn was, in fact, hamstrung, if you will, by the late Cardinal Anthony Bellaclavica, I guess is how you pronounce it, and that he had no authority to remove priests in his ministry because of the orders from higher-ups. And, of course, he alleges that he repeatedly told the higher-ups about the abuse. I take it that the judge, Teresa Samina, did not buy that. She basically described Monsignor Lynn as being a monster in clerical garb, destroying the souls of children. That is pretty strong stuff.
Well, it is strong language, but we think it's appropriate. Monsignor Lynn is technically correct. He couldn't defrock priests. That was his boss's job. But he could have, at any time over more than a dozen years, he could have called the police, he could have told others to call the police. He could have urged victims to call the police. He could have sent anonymous letters to the police. He could have resigned his job. He had many, many options, ways he could protect kids. And yet what he chose to do instead was protect himself, his reputation, his career, and the reputations of his supervisors. So the notion that Monsignor Lin was somehow some low-level, powerless flunky, the judge didn't buy it, the jury didn't buy it, and we shouldn't buy it either.
But what is the story with the late Cardinal Anthony Bevilacqua, who clearly was in, would seem to be more guilty than Monsignor Lin?
Sadly, because he never faced questioning on the witness stand, it'll be hard to say whose guilt is more severe. Certainly, Bevilacqua was among the most corrupt Catholic officials. He was a canon lawyer, he was a civil lawyer, he was a brilliant man. And instead of using his talents and skills to safeguard his flock, he used them to endanger his flock. He ordered, for example, lists of credibly accused and proven and admitted child molesting clerics to be shredded. You know, and sadly, he's much more the norm than the aberration in the Catholic hierarchy.
Again, I'm speaking with David Clossie, the executive director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, the largest and oldest self-help group of victims of clergy molestation in the United States. So, David, have you ever, it's clearly it must be haunting you and the members of your group to try and understand the mentality, not to mention the morality, of people like the Cardinal, who knew, you say he's a brilliant man, a lawyer, he knew exactly what was going on and ordered the shredding of lists of pedophile priests. Have you ever been able to figure out the motivation of so-called religious men and these incredibly unchristian actions where their priority is protecting the institution, not those under their care that they're ministering to?
Well, I think Lord Acton said it best when he said that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. You know, let's face it, the Catholic Church is a monarchy, and every bishop is the lord of his own kingdom, and he answers to virtually no one. On paper, of course, bishops answer to the Pope. But there's one pope, there are 5,000 bishops spread across the globe. So in reality, every bishop answers to no one. And under that kind of an unhealthy system, of course, power is going to be abused. And I think the second crucial factor is that Vatican officials have virtually never denounced or disciplined or demoted or defrocked a single church official who put kids in harm's way. And if that's the case, then, of course, we shouldn't be surprised that bishops conceal child sex crimes. They never get punished for it, and they sometimes get rewarded for it, so why wouldn't they act in such a callous way? And that's why the secular authorities have to step up, like they did in Philadelphia, to really punish those who protect predators instead of protecting kids. That's the only way there'll be real change within the Catholic hierarchy, we're convinced.
But what explains their priorities of being more willing to pay out lots of money to silence those victims who have complained? And it's apparently that people have been complaining for a long time, and I'm sure you can fill us in on that. The idea that these priests get shuffled around and they go into counseling and they get indulged, whereas the only way that the victims get any redress is by going to the courts. And it's not as if they're compensated out of real contrition on the part of the Catholic Church. They're compensated as a kind of reluctant public relations gesture.
Well, I think that's exactly right. You've characterized it perfectly. This may sound harsh, but the Catholic hierarchy doesn't reward risk takers. It rewards company men, men who toe the line, men who don't step out of line. And I think a lot of bishops, even those who you know, really deep down have good, kind hearts, fundamentally, when it comes to child sex crimes and cover-ups, they're timid, they're scared. And they have a PR person or PR staff who says, you know, you let us handle the public side of this, and don't bother yourself with it. And they have a team of lawyers who say, we've kept these things under wraps for decades. You know, you go out and do your spiritual work, and you let us handle these pedophile priests. And so bishops, I think, you know, are glad to turn over a thorny, complicated, hurtful mess to the experts on their staff. And I think they're happy to just do what has always been done, and that explains their continued recklessness and deceit and callousness. I mean, I don't think bishops sit around all day and plot and scheme, how can we help predators, how can we hurt kids? But sadly, even if that's not, you know, their conscious thinking and their intent, that's what happens because they're essentially relatively timid men.
So again, I'm speaking with David Clossie, the Executive Director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, the largest and oldest self-help group of victims of clergy molestation in the United States. And we're talking about the sentencing today of Monsignor William Lynn, who was given 3.5 to 7 years for having been found guilty in June of child endangerment. The co-defendant in the case, a priest named James Brennan, the jury was hung on his conviction, and the district attorney in Philadelphia has announced that they will retry Brennan. And that seems a bit odd, though, that the guy that covered up gets sentenced and the guy that actually did the molestation, in this case of a, it was an attempted rape of a 14-year-old, assume it was a boy, he doesn't get sentenced, or he gets off, but because he's going to get retried. Do you have any understanding of why that happened?
Well, it was a very long, complicated trial. There were more than 2,000 documents introduced as evidence. It lasted 6 weeks. I think what was the undoing of Monsignor Lynn was that he and other church officials kept meticulous records about how they deceived parishioners and stonewalled prosecutors and made excuses. His co-defendant, Father Brennan, prosecutors announced just yesterday that they will retry that case, and we're grateful for that because we do believe that Father Brennan is a child molester and he's dangerous and he should be jailed. But certainly the big fish, if you were, the man that the prosecutors focused on most heavily, was Monsignor Lynn, and we're grateful that he'll be doing some jail time, and we hope that that will send a very powerful signal to other Catholic officials, current and former, who know about or suspect child sex crimes and are keeping their mouths shut even now.
Well, what Lynn was being found guilty of and sentenced for is covering up the activities of a priest called Edward Avery, who was convicted in 1999 of sexual assault. His rap sheet is pretty appalling, isn't it? I mean,
it's absolutely appalling. And even though the charges were specific to Brennan and Avery, luckily the judge let prosecutors introduce scores and scores of pages and evidence and witnesses that dealt with dozens of other pedophile priests in Philadelphia, because prosecutors wanted to get the point across to the jury, hey, this case, the Brennan case, the Avery case, you know, these are not exceptions to the rule. This is part and parcel of how Philadelphia Catholic officials for decades have hidden child sex crimes.
Well, in the case of Avery, Monsignor Lind knew he was guilty, and he helped steer him into a treatment program, which again shows you the priorities. The victims aren't treated, only the predators are. And then he was sent off, Avery was sent off to a new parish where he assaulted an altar boy.
That's right. And Monsignor Lynn was supposed to be on the, trying to remember the phrase, kind of a review panel or a monitoring board that was supposed to keep close tabs on Avery. And in fact, a year went by before that monitoring committee met even one time. So Monsignor Lynn tries to claim, I did my best, my hands were tied, it was really up to my boss. But that's not what the record showed, and that's not what the judge and jury believed.
So tell us about how your organization that you're the executive director of, David Clossy, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, how it was formed. I mean, I think we all know why it was formed, but how it was formed and how difficult it was for you to reach this point where finally somebody is actually going to go to jail. I mean, it's been, we're talking about decades here of serial predators.
Oh, certainly. Yes, we, well, our group was founded in 1988 in Chicago by a social worker. You know, we're a nonprofit support and advocacy group. Our mission is to heal the wounded and protect the vulnerable. And yes, it has been a long, tough slog, a long, tough struggle to expose predators and help victims and prevent crimes and cover-ups. And this is a watershed moment. 6,100 priests in America are proven, admitted, or credibly accused child molesters. 6,100. And yet, finally now, in 2012, roughly 25 years after the first pedophile priest case made national headlines in America, only now is one church supervisor being locked up for his role in it. So that just shows that, I think it shows two things. Number one, there's a great deal of work that remains. And number two, that if victims do find the courage and strength to speak up and call 911 and cooperate with law enforcement, sometimes, even years late, sometimes justice can be done, prevention can happen, and healing can take place as well.
Well, I've spoken recently with Sister Simone Campbell, who was singled out by the Vatican for teaching sort of radical feminism and the religious women of the United States, by extension, not being sufficiently vocal on being anti-abortion, pro-male priesthood, etc. And it just when you talk about, what, 52, how many pedophile priests in the United States?
6,100. Bishop's own admission. That's their figure, not ours. Right. We think the number is, of course, substantially higher.
Right. That's over 6,000. And you don't know the number of how many clergy we have of Catholic priests in the country, what percentage that would be?
Well, it's bishops claim that's about 4% of the
priests. Right. Well, I'm just saying that it seems that, again, the priorities of the Vatican are so strange and so incomprehensible that they're going after the religious women who really do the Lord's work. They do toil in the vineyards. They do minister to the sick and poor. And yet you've got these kind of corporate-type company men, as you described them, being indulged by the Vatican and, you know, the millions. How much money has been paid out? It's an astounding figure, isn't it?
I think the last estimate I saw was between $2 and $3 billion. But, of course, hard data is very, very tough to come by. Church officials are almost as secretive about finances as they are about pedophile priests. And I think you do bring up a good point. The Vatican sometimes seems fixated on what some adults say to other adults. We think they should be fixated on what some adults do criminally to many children. You know, adult Catholics can decide what books to read and what theologians to listen to. You know, they have some choices. You know, innocent kids, vulnerable kids, they don't have a lot of choices. And if we're going to focus on protecting anybody from anything, we ought to focus first and foremost on protecting boys and girls from child predators within the priesthood. You know, the first rule of a doctor is, number one, do no harm. And we think that should be the first rule within the church as well. Let's get rid of the dangerous priests and nuns and bishops and seminarians who molest kids, and then focus on other matters.
Well, just in closing, David Clossie, what will change this culture? Obviously, they're more prepared to pay off than they are to deal with whatever the root causes of this problem of having so many pedophile priests. And my understanding is that, in fact, I saw an article recently in the New York Times of a seminary somewhere where there was only one candidate, that the clergy is not attracting young men anymore, and those that they attract are not particularly healthy. Doesn't this come down to the Vatican's reluctance to even discuss the idea of ordaining women and of allowing priests to marry? Because it seems to me that a lot of these problems would go away if priests were allowed to marry. They wouldn't be so obsessed with abortion if a priest's daughter got pregnant. All of those, the social issues that seem to obsess the clergy would go away, because I think of one, obviously, having spoken a few times to Sister Simone Campbell, you recognize the tremendous sort of compassion and wisdom of the women in the church. But compared to the men, it's like a different universe.
Well, we in SNAP try to be pragmatic and focus on where we can make change. And so I think that real changes are going to come in three places. Number one, victims, witnesses, and whistleblowers must continue to speak up. If victims, witnesses, and whistleblowers stay silent, there's not even a chance for reform. So victims and witnesses and whistleblowers have to find the courage to step forward. Secondly, police and prosecutors have to do what they did in Philadelphia and ignore the power and prestige and popularity of the church hierarchy and go after wrongdoers, no matter what titles they have or clothes they wear. And number three, lawmakers have to reform these archaic statutes that make it easy for child molesters to run out the clock on their crimes and make it easy for men like Cardinal Bevilacqua and Monsignor Lynn to conceal those crimes and escape responsibility. Ultimately, we think that the real reform is going to come outside the church hierarchy and despite the church hierarchy, especially when the secular authorities use their powers to investigate and prosecute the wrongdoers in the church.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Clossie.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Again, I've been speaking with David Clossie, the Executive Director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, the largest and oldest self-help group of four victims of clergy molestation in the United States. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the pain in Spain.
Blue Spanish eyes, teardrops are falling from your Spanish eyes. Please, please don't cry.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anthony Geist, Professor of Spanish and Comparative Literature at the University of Washington in Seattle. His field of research concerns art and literature of the Spanish Civil War, and he published a photo essay of the Seattle area Lincoln Brigade veterans, co-authored with the Spanish photojournalist Jose Moreno, called Passing the Torch, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and its Legacy of Hope. Anthony Geist is the Vice Chair of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anthony Geist.
Thank you, Ian. Pleasure to be here.
And you're just back from Spain, and although you're certainly not an economist, I don't think you have to be an economist to feel the pain of the average working Spaniard and middle-class Spaniard who's feeling the pinch now. They just had to accept a really hideous dose of austerity, and now the bond markets are pounding the Spanish debt. It's reached a euro high record of 7.57% in terms of the cost of borrowing, which is unsustainable. What's your sense of how the people are going to endure this in Spain?
Well, you know, it was palpable on the streets. I just got back 2 days ago. And you can see it, you can feel it, in talking with people, you hear it. There's a kind of quiet desperation. There are lots of closed businesses, empty shop windows in increasing numbers. People still go out. This was July. July and August are the big vacation months in Spain, and the restaurants were not full, particularly at night. I mean, some of the traditional spots in the south, in Cádiz, where I was, where you used to have to wait an hour for a table, we were able to walk right in and get a table. So there's that, that people are not spending. People either don't have money or they're not willing to spend what they do have. Sales tax has just gone up. The IVA has gone up from value-added tax to 21%, which I think is having the opposite effect. Rather than generating revenue for the state, it's actually discouraging people from spending. So I would say that there is, for the first time this trip, I've noticed a kind of generalized sense of desperation.
And the region of Catalonia, which of course is very significant in the work that you've done on the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in the Spanish Civil War, they have requested an emergency help from the government. This conservative government is probably, my instincts tell me, they're not favorably disposed to Catalonia?
No, there's been, there's a centuries-old tensions between Madrid and Catalonia, between Castile and Catalonia. And that continues to today. It's linguistic, it's cultural, it's a feeling on the streets as well. However, the state is going to have to bail out Catalonia. Somebody's going to have to bail, probably Germany. The EU is going to have to bail out Spain. It's gotten absolutely unsustainable. I don't know if you've seen today's news. There's huge forest fires in Catalonia right now, which have caused several deaths. And a number of people feel that the fact that these forest fires are so intense and out of control has to do with the cutbacks that they've experienced in public services, in police force, in firefighters, and in the people who take care of the national parks and forests. The maintenance has been neglected and deferred, and so the forest fires correspondingly much fiercer.
Well, that's the nature of and mechanism of austerity, isn't it? The municipalities, the cities, the towns are the ones that suffer. The state and local budgets suffer. We've seen here in the state of California the cutbacks in education, the cutbacks in services, the cutbacks in the courts that are just, you can't get your day in court anymore in California. You have to wait for years. This seems to be a global pattern that the powerful financial institutions get off scot-free, whereas the citizens and the cities and the municipalities and the
people,
states get squeezed.
Yes, exactly so. And there's an increasing sense of that in Spain. I just coincidentally got a long email from a very close friend of mine in Granada just yesterday, saying that he teaches at the University of Granada, and he was scheduled to have an early retirement. The state negotiated with him a golden handshake. He's 62. He was looking forward to that. He had, in fact, already celebrated. It was supposed to start September 30th. They've rescinded that. As a consequence, he will have to continue working, but his salary has been cut 30%. in the last 2 years. As a consequence, he has to move out of Granada, out of his apartment in Granada, to an outlying village where the rent is much cheaper. And he reports that that people in general are totally discouraged and disenchanted with both political parties, both the Socialists and with the Popular Party. And he feels that the welfare state that's been built up over the last 40 years, since the death of Franco and even under beginning under Franco, is being eroded, and the democracy also is being eroded. So it's a kind of bleak outlook.
Again, let me remind the audience I'm speaking with Anthony Geister, who's a professor of Spanish and comparative literature at the University of Washington in Seattle. You mentioned that the Spanish democracy itself is in trouble, that the social safety net is being shredded. That seems to be happening throughout a lot of European countries, starting with austerity in England and France, and of course Greece is largely falling off the cliff at the moment, and Spain and Italy. Is the elite in Europe dictating this? Is there a subtext here that in order to compete in the global economy with, you know, workers in Sri Lanka, we all have to take a hit? It's not never been stated, but I can't help but feel that there is something going on here.
Well, that's a really interesting question, Ian, actually. You know, there were such great hopes put on the euro economy 11 years ago, 12 years ago, and that this economic crisis has really thrown the euro into disarray, and people are questioning it. There's talk of certain countries abandoning the euro, going back to their national currencies. I don't know if that's likely to happen. It would not be difficult to see this, the austerity measures, the cutbacks, the rolling back the unions, as certainly a tactic that favors the financial institutions at the very least. Maybe taking it a step further, it's a way of creating cheaper labor so that the European Union can compete with outsourcing to the developing countries. But, you know, that's really, I don't think that's Europe's strength, is cheap labor. I think Europe's strength is in manufacturing and agriculture. Spain is still very largely an agricultural powerhouse in many ways. But it is, something is going on. That seems to me that's clear. Exactly what it is, I don't know.
Well, then let's turn to the democracy itself in Spain. Of course, there is a very painful history there of the Spanish Civil War, which was a precursor to World War II, which the fascists won. Franco was absolutely brutal in retribution. Hundreds of thousands were killed and disappeared. And there was an attempt by a very colorful Spanish judge, Garzón, to have a kind of truth and reconciliation. And then the old establishment went after him, and now he's in trouble. There's certainly no movement on that part. Now you have a conservative government. You said that the average Spaniard, it's a plague on both their houses. They're fed up with the socialists and the conservatives. Right. But tell us about the kind of political DNA of the country with its unresolved divisions here, and the extent to which recently, when the recent round of austerity was imposed, you saw a lot of miners in the streets. You get a feeling that there's a combustible mix there and a lot of anger and a lot of distrust of the old conservative elite and the military in that country.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Spain is, you know, is still a deeply divided country. The Spanish Civil War, which was ended 80 years ago, is still in many ways an open wound in the country. You mentioned Judge Garzón, who was removed from office precisely because of his attempt to authorize the opening of the exhumations of the mass graves. There are over 115,000 people, victims of the Spanish Civil War, most of them victims of Franco violence, who are still lying in unmarked graves. and their families want to unearth them and give them a decent burial and close that wound. Garzón, of course, was removed from office because of this. So, you know, these in many ways, these are the memory wars. The Popular Party, the Partido Popular, is in many ways understood as the heir to the Franco regime. You know, it's now a couple of generations past. But an interesting thing has happened in the last 20 or 25 years, and that is Spain, which is a parliamentary system, has become increasingly a bipartite system. There's a conservative party and the socialist party. All the smaller opposition parties really have disappeared. And I think that is, you know, a significant difference in a parliamentary system when it becomes dominated by two parties who alternate in power. That said, compared with the American electoral system, you do not have to be a millionaire to get elected prime minister in Spain, unlike what we see happening in the United States right now.
Well, I recall, just anecdotally, Anthony Geist, that in the mid-1960s, I was in Barcelona and I went into a bookstore, and this is when Franco was still in power. And I went into a bookstore, and a group of young fascists came in and attacked the owner and threw black ink all over the shelves that contained copies of Jean-Paul Sartre's writing and other considered subversive writers. And I must say, I was very young at the time, but I saw the face of fascism, and it was scary as hell.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, and there's a strong recollection of that still in Spain today. Part of the problem, you know, recently is that Zapatero, the socialist prime minister, the previous prime minister, was hit with this huge economic recession, and the construction bubble burst in Spain, and he was blamed for it, much the way that Obama has been blamed for the turn the economy has taken in the United States, which I think is unfair. I think they could perhaps both be faulted for not having a more vigorous response to the situation. But it can't be laid at their feet. And nonetheless, Zapatero's response to the economic situation was very, very weak, and I think people were very disappointed with that. And as a consequence, the Popular Party won overwhelmingly throughout the country, both in national and municipal elections. And people, of course, have become immediately disenchanted with Rajoy and his inability to do anything effective with regards to the recession and the cutbacks and austerity measures. There are a number of people who feel really that what is needed is a vigorous stimulus package rather than austerity, that in order to get money in circulation, you have to spend money. I tend to agree with that.
Well, just to return to the big picture, if you will, Anthony Geist, again, professor of Spanish and comparative literature at the University of Washington in Seattle. Three countries, Spain, Italy, and France, seem to be somewhat coming together to sort of gang up on Germany. Germany, of course, is holding fast to demanding austerity, and German politicians are afraid that direct capital injections into struggling banks, as they recently did in Spain, and large interventions in the bond market, that they don't want to mutualize the EU debt. They want Spain to be responsible for its debt and therefore force it into making more concessions. And you wonder how much more blood you can get out of that stone. It's not realistic on the part of the Germans to expect this method of being the kind of stern teacher, if you will, is not working. And this thing continues.
It's having the opposite effect, actually. Yeah.
Right. And France's foreign minister have called for a firewall for Spain. And then the Spanish budget minister suggested the European Central Bank should act more like the US Fed. All of these are welcome pronouncements, but you don't feel that there's a connection between what these leaders are saying and the reality of whether anything's getting done about it. And I must say, this has been going on for over 2 years now.
Yes, it's been going on for a long time. The situation has gotten worse and worse, the situation on the street in Spain. Unemployment is just rampant. The latest figures I've heard is that 45 or 50% of people between the ages of 18 and 35 have never had their first job, never had a job at all. And in that age group, the unemployment is again around 50%. There's been a brain drain. Any Spaniard, well, any qualified young Spaniard who is not tied down by family is looking for opportunities elsewhere outside the country. And it's going to be a heavy price to pay. Angela Merkel, by the way, is sort of universally despised and scorned in Spain for her hard-nosed, hard line on the austerity.
Well, you know, in part, the Bankia, the real estate bank that went bust and dragged down the rest of the economy, I mean, you can't blame the Germans, but the Germans were the customers for these second homes that were being built and were overbuilt, right? So they're
way overbuilt. There are, we may have mentioned this at some point in the past, but there are over a million new unoccupied apartments in Spain today. A million. It's an astonishing figure. There was a totally irresponsible development and building policies with, you know, junk mortgages and easy credit and so forth. So it's been, and that's what we're paying the price for now.
Well, we saw that movie, too, here in the United States. I think in many ways we invented that.
Yes, that's right.
Well,
that's exactly right, and exported it. Yeah.
Right. Well, Anthony Geist, I thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you bet, Ian. Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Anthony Geist, who's a professor of Spanish and comparative literature at the University of Washington in Seattle. His field of research concerns art and literature of the Spanish Civil War, and he published a photo essay of the Seattle area Lincoln Brigade veterans, co-authored with Spanish photojournalist Jose Moreno, called Passing the Torch, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and its Legacy of Hope. And Anthony Geist is the vice chair of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.